Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepios. On this commencement Sunday, we're considering the passage of time. Tonight, we hear the work of student journalists at BU. Students in the narrative radio journalism class spent the past semester finding and then refining stories related to time. Let's begin with the traditional path for many college students after graduation. For most of them, it's time to jump as high as possible onto the employment ladder. Once on that ladder, you continue that climb in pursuit of higher wages and wider recognition. But some students choose to spend their time after college in pursuit of personal satisfaction, even at the bottom of the ladder. Student reporter Aaron Nabney introduces us to one of those students.
Welcome to the Propaganda Show!
My name is Andrew Giustino. I graduated in 2017 from Boston University with a degree in film and television. Now, I have two part-time jobs. One is at Cambridge Community Television, and one is as a barista at a coffee shop.
Like most film degree grads, Giustino's classmates left Boston behind to chase their dreams of being hired by major producers in LA. But not Giustino. Instead, he decided to make his own show from scratch. It airs on Cambridge Community Television.
So I'm going to bring up our first performer. She one time convinced me to go to a comedy show that was with performers that were entirely naked, but I did not know they'd be.
This is probably the only opportunity I had to like really be in charge of something with this much creative power around it at this age. The show I do is called The Propaganda Show. The principle of my show is finding things that I like and then, you know, propagating that.
Have anything to plug? Just sort of like eat more vegetables?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good one.
In exchange for producing his show, he's allowed use of the community studio with all the cameras and other equipment he needs. It's often more than enough for his small 5-person crew of volunteers. Giustino recruits the acts for his show through social media and by reaching out to artists and comedians he likes. Talent, he finds, is in abundance in Boston. But finding an audience is difficult when you're starting a show from scratch.
Most people would probably say I'm doing it wrong. I don't think it's the very typical way. For me, I feel very happy with what I'm doing and very inspired by it. But I can also totally see someone being like, not for me. I need to go right to Los Angeles and I need to, you know, work for Matt Damon right now.
As well as writing, producing, and recruiting talent for his show, Giustino's up at 5 a.m. every day for his part-time job as a barista. So he has enough money to pay the rent.
It's like a boat or something. You've two leaks spring, and then you plug your fingers into those, and then another one pops out. So it's always trying to see, like, can I keep this boat afloat? And, like, is it worth it, or should I just swim from here? But the thing that's been good for me is that the people that come onto the show so far...
Onto the boat.
They're like, I'm so glad I didn't swim.
It can be a struggle for Giustino to keep the boat afloat by himself, but his pride in what he's doing makes it worth it.
Great job.
Why, thank you.
One more round of applause for Taylor.
It comes down to simply, what do you really want? For me, it was more of a personal goal by any age. In my lifetime, I'd like to have felt like I got to create something. And that's why, for me, subverting it was necessary. Also, at the same time, feel comfortable to say, maybe I want something different, you know? Maybe I, you know, I'm not looking to be a PA and then a producer and then a head of a network by the time I'm 30. Maybe I just want to write in a coffee shop.
Giustino doesn't see himself doing this forever, though. He hopes that when his time with The Propaganda Show comes to a natural end, he'll move on to work for the big names in LA and get started on the career that his peers began a few years prior. The lesson for him is that hurrying down that road right away doesn't have to be the only option post-graduation. Taking a creative detour can be worth your while. Boston University professor of film and television, Chris Cavalieri, agrees.
There are many legitimate professional paths. It's not one path better than the other. Rather, it's the strategy, logic, and purpose to pursue a particular path that needs to be evaluated. That needs to be valid.
no matter how successful, I'll look back at this and say, I'm glad I did that, though, because I needed to know. I needed to try that first, because it was just an itch I had to scratch. The truth is, some people, you know, definitely just say, no, always go with safe. I say, yeah, no, try to really look at things and say, why not? Because if the why not really is just more of like a shrug, then forget that and do the why not, you know, go for it.
That's the end of the show. Thank you, and good night.
As Justino sees it, there's no risk for him right now. He figures he'll have plenty of time to worry about a career later, but he wants some personal fulfillment first. I'm Erin Nabney.
Time is constantly on the minds of those doing time. The experience is usually most difficult for those deprived of human interaction in solitary confinement. Student reporter Sarika Rahn took a look at solitary confinement and the movement to do away with it.
This model of punishment was once known as the Pennsylvania model. It was established by the Pennsylvania Quakers to inspire reflection and penitence. But that's not what it produced. Natasha Frost is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Northeastern University, who studies solitary confinement.
The solitary confinement Pennsylvania model back in the 1800s was seen as having lots of problems. Inmates tended to not do well psychologically, and some people said it made people crazy, right? This is back in the 1800s.
And people still suffer mental health consequences from solitary confinement today. Dana Mock is president and CEO of the Massachusetts Association of Mental Health.
There are people who have, after some periods of confinement, who have never had a history of psychosis or hallucination, for example, who begin to have hallucinatory symptoms. Some people regress in their functioning, particularly people who may have been untreated for a psychotic disorder.
Opposition to solitary confinement has grown in recent years. Among those pushing for its elimination is Michael Cox with the Boston-based organization Black and Pink. He spent 5.5 years in prison.
I ended up serving a total of 5.5 years in state prison. And I would say probably about 4 or 5 months of that was spent in solitary confinement, broken up into different smaller periods.
As a gay man, Cox was targeted in prison.
I had a roommate who started tickling my feet. And it started off kind of benign, and I know it's kind of funny. But eventually it started not being funny because I was just getting weird vibes off him. And it started with my feet, but it started to move up my ankles and then my shins and my knees, and it started to get not okay.
When Cox approached prison guards and asked for a cell switch, he says he ended up suffering unexpected repercussions. Cox was placed in administrative segregation. That's the official term for solitary confinement.
For me, I would just kind of withdraw in my head. I would just live out these fantasies, these very intricate fantasies, when I was more in control. And then at other times, it was more of like a psychedelic experience where it was just the thoughts just would not stop rushing.
The only relief from Cox's dark enclosure was the one-hour recreational period prisons are required to provide to those in solitary confinement daily. However, Cox found recreational periods to oftentimes be dehumanizing.
At least for me, they had always come to my cell and they would wake me up at 6 or 7 in the morning for my recreational period. And so if I took it, I would be chained, my feet would be chained, my hands would be shackled, and I would be let out to what we call the dog cage. And so it's basically an oversized kennel.
After being released from solitary confinement, Cox says his senses were overwhelmed.
In contrast to being in your cell all day, in solitary confinement, it's kind of mind-blowing. And coming out was like overstimulation. And so I noticed myself just regressing back into myself and like not wanting to interact with folks, not wanting to go where there would be a lot of action, like in the gym, for example.
The anxiety Cox felt persists today.
I joke sometimes with my roommate that, you know, I used to kind of be like a puppy. You know, I used to always want to be playful with people and interact. And now I feel like I'm more of a cat person, right? Like a cat kind of comes around when it wants. It kind of goes off when it wants.
Stories like that of Cox have inspired change in Massachusetts. Recently, Governor Charlie Baker signed a sweeping criminal justice reform bill that calls for correctional facilities to define a new, more humane, restrictive housing concept. I'm Sarika Ram. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you, I'll
be waiting. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, stories about time provided by students in the narrative radio journalism class at Boston University's College of Communication. With the passage of time comes the effort to remember human history. Boston is a city steeped in history, but only a small part of it is on display on the Freedom Trail. Student reporter Vincent Gabriel took a tour of another part of Boston history.
We feel that this is a rescue mission in some ways, that we're trying to rescue history from being forgotten or erased.
This is Mark Crone.
It's not so much that we are on the fringes of history, it's that we were in the center but not seen. But if you pull one out, this is kind of how it looks and how it kind of looks even today. Somebody bound them, I'm not sure who.
Crone is on the board of the History Project, a volunteer historical society and archive of the Massachusetts LGBTQ community. The project is a small group. They've been gathering and archiving LGBTQ ephemera since the 80s. The all-volunteer crew works out of a small office by the Back Bay Orange Line station. Crone says much of the collection relies on posthumous donations, save from the trash.
We collect things that some people don't even know are important. So if, let's say, somebody dies and they're not even out to their family, they'll put everything to the curb. Mm. But then maybe they're out to one person, like a niece or a nephew. That person might gobble some things up and give them to us. So we'll get boxes. Okay. We collect some peculiar things, mm-hmm. like swizzle sticks, ashtrays from closed bars, T-shirts, protest signs.
Archivists collect oral histories, journals, and back issues of LGBTQ newspapers. Without them, volunteers say we risk losing people's voices from the historical record. In the public garden, Crone stops just past Ether Monument at a path that runs up Beacon Street. He explains that it was once known as Pansy's Walk.
It's where men in the 19-teens and 10s and 20s would parade down there back and forth until they met someone. Go that way. Yeah, actually, we should go that way and then just take a left. I think it'll be worth it.
At the base of Beacon Hill, Crone stops in front of Toscano, an expensive Italian place. It used to be a Schrafft's, a sort of upscale, turn-of-the-century Friendly's luncheonette chain for ladies of means. It was also the haunt of one Prescott Townsend, a 1920s Boston Brahmin.
He was a gay activist, of all things. Every year he would go to the State House and file a bill for gay rights. And they would have to listen to him because he was from an old family and he had influence, but they would politely turn him down and never file the bill.
Crone says Townsend was an eccentric character. He took in gay runaways and ran with the experimental theater crowd in Providence. During World War II, he was arrested and served time for committing a, quote, unnatural and lascivious act. Tucked between Tufts Medical Center, the Park Plaza Hotel, and the Mass Pike is an area that used to be the center of LGBTQ life in the city. In part, this was because of rooming houses for unwed men and women.
Some of the earliest gay bars came from speakeasies in Bay Village. Gay people have lived in the South End for a long time. You could move to the South End on the pretense that it was a rooming house, it was cheap, you were close to the clubs which you could frequent, and you could also live with other men, and nobody questioned you. It was normal.
Jocks in Bay Village is the oldest gay bar in Boston. It dates back to the 30s. Nestled behind the Revere Hotel on Piedmont Street, Jacques used to share the block with many other gay bars, Crone says. The History Project archives are full of testimony that straight neighbors often complained about gay bars, that police would raid LGBTQ spaces. But, in an ironic twist, it's no longer the straight community that's trying to get rid of Jacques, but the gay one.
The people who want to shut down Jacques are now gay. They're gentrifiers, they're gay, they don't like jocks. It's too old and dirty and nasty. It's not something that they really appreciate. They like shiny new things. So they all just go to the shiny new thing, and they leave the old one behind. But the old one was here when the chips were down. There were fundraisers for AIDS here when nobody else would do it. There were, you know, there were events for candidates, gay candidates.
Bars were central to the LGBTQ experience in Boston and everywhere until very recently. The Napoleon Club, the Black Cat. There was at least one lesbian bar, the Woman's Bar. Everyone went to bars. There wasn't much of an alternative.
A bar is not very safe, but in other ways, in the 60s and 70s, it was the safest place you could be if you were a gay person.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the sad thing is there was a lot of unhealthy behavior, and there was psychological impact, too. Suicide, drug addiction, overdoses, alcoholism, took a lot of lives, too.
Crone stresses that the increase in acceptance was ultimately healthy. The reliance on bars promoted a lot of unhealthy things like alcoholism. Now, LGBTQ people are able to go to inclusive spaces, whether they're explicitly LGBTQ-themed or not. Crone calls that a victory for the community.
This is what we fought for. So people like me are like, where are all the gay bars? Yeah, I do miss them, but I also understand this is what we fought for. So, you know, greater acceptance is good.
The History Project has uncovered important places and people in the LGBTQ history of Massachusetts. Its archivists expect to find a lot more. But after decades of ignoring that part of history, they say there's a lot that's lost forever. I'm Vincent Gabriel.
Another part of the city's history revolves around its transportation systems. For those who used it, the city's old L is difficult to forget. As the old elevated Orange Line in Boston has changed a lot in the time since the L stopped running, as student reporter Michelle Santiago discovered.
Washington Street is where the old L would pass on its way to the South End and Chinatown from Forest Hills and Roxbury. Longtime South End resident and author Allison Barnett has a painting of the L's Northampton Street station in her apartment.
On the last night that it ran, we, the South, you know, the Washington Street Corridor Coalition, held a wake on the train. We got on at each station with a coffin that said Boston Elevated 1901 to 1987. We had ministers, you know, saying prayers. It was a big thing.
The New York Times called the L a dingy, elevated, and a dirty and noisy project. 1987 was the year the L was too old and deteriorated to keep running. Today's Orange Line has new stops and Silver Line buses that travel the original route.
I always say every single day I miss that L. As I stand there waiting for that stupid Silver Line, pushing my way in, it's almost always packed, unbelievably packed.
For Barnett, the L was the lifeblood of Washington Street. But over on Harrison Avenue, local historian Russ Lopez completely disagrees.
I mean, I hated to walk underneath it because it seemed like you always got dripped on. Even if there wasn't a cloud in the sky, something would just come down, right? And on top of your head, right? You're like, oh, God, what was it? What was it?
Think of the noises Green Line trains make when at Packard's Corner. Think of the screeching tracks, the rattling train cars, the doors hissing open and shut. Now imagine it inches away from your bedroom window.
It also didn't run very well the last years. It was very decrepit. I saw a report that said in the early 60s or maybe late 50s, they were already knew they needed to replace it because it was falling apart.
In the mid-80s, business was booming all along the L. Places like Chico's Variety Store, Lee's Chinese, and Skippy White's were popular destinations.
When the BRA came through, they took everything on that side of the street.
Skippy White owns and runs one of the city's most iconic record stores.
They took all the buildings down on that side of the street, the side that I was on. And eventually I was able to find a location at 1763 Washington Street, and that was right opposite the station. Right opposite where people came down stairs from the elevated train.
That article was published in 1981. In it, a store clerk at Jim's Variety says she had been held up on the job 15 times in 10 months. Russ Lopez remembers a more affordable city, when rents were just starting to hit $1,000 a month.
And that made the city more vibrant and a better place in some respect, many respects, and that it was just so much going on, right? And, you know, you'd run into people that were doing great works of art, and or writers, or anarchists.
Taking down the L got rid of the noise. It turned those neighborhoods into safer places to live, but only for those that could afford it. So maybe people don't miss the L itself. They do miss the city that thrived below it. I'm Michelle Santiago.
If you don't stutter, you probably take the relatively short time it takes to get through a sentence for granted. But people who do stutter must become aware of just how long it takes to express a thought. Student reporter Meredith Ramore has that story.
I'll be your bridge, your troubled water. When you're down, when you're down, I will carry you like a bridge, your troubled water. I will
Edmund Metzold is a tenor in the Boston Gay Men's Chorus. He also has a stutter. Like most stutterers, he doesn't usually stutter when he sings, but occasionally he does.
I can sometimes stutter when I sing if I'm singing alone. In college, I had a voice teacher who also stuttered. So I would every so often stutter when doing vocal warm-ups, and he'd say, don't think of it like a warm-up. Think of it as like you're really singing a song.
Metzold stutters less frequently when he's around people he knows or when he's impassioned about something.
If you have to yell for help, you'll never stutter. Like, just your body will make sure you get out those words because it's so important.
So what causes stuttering? This varies from person to person. Basically, stuttering occurs when the brain's timing is off. One part of the brain can't keep up with the rest of the brain. Boston University's speech neuroscience lab director Frank Gunther says speech is just a string of items.
Those individual items we usually call phonemes. So an ah is a phoneme, a vowel, or a consonant.
For example, take the three phonemes k, a, and t. In a typical brain, these sounds are slightly overlap to form the word cat. This assembly line of phonemes is called a motor program. According to Gunther, people who stutter can't initiate motor programs well.
Speech actually is quite a taxing thing on your motor system because it requires such accurate timing. The best fluency-inducing conditions are choral reading, where you're with a group of people who are reading. Singing is another big one, or speaking to a metronome. And what all of these things have in common is that they tell you the timing signals of when to initiate the motor program, but it sounds terribly unnatural. And they actually prefer the stutter to sounding weird, like a robot or something like that.
Metzold agrees. He thinks of speaking and singing as different things.
I think it would be more weird to sing everything you want to say than to stutter. If I sang, they'd be like, wait, where does this guy think he is?
So is it better to accept your stutter or to try to fix it?
Just ask you to imagine what your fear looks like in your body and where is it located?
My neck, you know, because that's where most of the stress kind of builds up.
And what shape would you say it is, or what size?
Baseball size.
Okay.
This is Diane Constantino, a clinical researcher who specializes in stuttering. Accepting your stutter and adopting a positive attitude toward your condition is one of the first things that Constantino teaches her clients. This approach is called acceptance and commitment therapy.
Once people know that I stutter, it doesn't bother me.
It's the revealing of it, that vulnerability.
Yeah.
Are you willing to experience some vulnerability in order to get to the other side, right? When you tell the person and then you know the benefits of that.
Is it better to acknowledge the stuttering or not to acknowledge the stuttering?
That's a really good question. It's normal for a person who stutters to try to hide it. And in doing so, they actually make it worse. And we recommend that they disclose their stuttering first. And what it does is it allows them to just talk. When we can just be ourselves fully, it is tremendously freeing and fulfilling. You know, coming out of the closet, so to speak. And in a sense, our clients come out about their stuttering.
That rings true for Metzold. He remembers a night when he went dancing with the LGBT group at the Dallas National Stuttering Association Conference.
I felt like I could be my most authentic self. And it was just like one of the best nights of my life. And showed me so much more the importance of being around people who really understand what you've been through.
Stuttering awareness advocates are usually put in one camp or another. Advocating for a cure or advocating for acceptance. It's hard to say which one will come first, but perhaps it's time for both. I'm Meredith Romori.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Time is our theme this evening as we hear stories about time prepared by narrative radio journalism students at the BU College of Communication. Whatever else it is, time is constant. So why, in most places, does the time change twice a year? One Massachusetts man sees no sense in it. Student reporter Alex Pena tells us about his effort to stop that tradition in New England and make the evenings a little bit brighter.
It's 5 p.m. on a cold December in Boston, the height of rush hour traffic. Workers step out of their offices to find that it's already pitch black outside. Most are used to it, but when Tom Emsweiler first moved here, he was shocked.
I knew I was moving north from Richmond, Virginia, but I had no idea how far I was moving east. So you can imagine my horror the first December I lived here when the sun set at 4:11 p.m. I thought to myself, there has to be a better way.
Emsweiler started looking into why we fall back an hour in November, why we spring forward in March, and what impact that has on people's health. Luckily for him, researchers had already wondered the same thing.
There are more car accidents, more heart attacks, more workplace accidents when we spring forward because everyone is losing an hour's sleep. We're giving millions of people jet lag all at the same time.
While some just accept this as a fact of life, that wasn't good enough for Emsweiler. So he wrote an op-ed for the Boston Globe in 2014 that got people talking.
I thought it was cool. You know, I showed my wife and showed my parents and everyone thought, great job. And I sort of thought it would end there because normally the stuff I write about is pretty dull. But unbeknownst to me, it kind of went viral.
Massachusetts resident Tom Emsweiler, he's got an idea.
Well, my guest is challenging our thinking about the need to set clocks ahead and then turn
them back.
That's
Tom Emsweiler, a citizen who inspired the state to create a commission.
Tom Emsweiler never thought much about time zones until he moved from D.C. to Massachusetts.
Then, in the summer of 2015, Emsweiler worked with his state senator, John Keenan from Quincy, to create a bill by request. This would allow Tom to present a bill with his name on it while using Senator Keenan to file it.
I've learned someone with more inside position on Beacon Hill informed me, we don't take those seriously. And I thought to myself, you know, they're probably right, but, you know, I don't really have another option.
But unlike most citizen-spawned bills that don't get very far, this one somehow ended up becoming part of Governor Baker's economic development bill.
But I don't really know, like, the moment that they decided, yep, let's put it in. But anyways, they put it in the bill, and it survived conference with the House, and it survived the governor's veto pen. And so in August of 2016, my little bill that could, my bill by request, which is not supposed to be serious, became law.
By November of that year, the new research commission voted 9-1 to recommend Massachusetts stay on daylight savings time all year round.
I was pretty sure we were going to win a majority, but I didn't know it would be so overwhelming.
The one holdout on the commission was State Representative Paul Frost, who argued that if Massachusetts had different time zones than bordering states, that could mean problems for business.
You could easily have someone who's in sales or doing a job and has to travel to all three states at once, and you can have, between November and March, have a different time zone than they are.
The commission's recommendation remains just that, a recommendation. But Emsweiler's optimistic that lawmakers will vote this year on making the change.
I mean, it wasn't supposed to go this far. So the op-ed wasn't supposed to be published. It wasn't supposed to get a bill passed, and the commission wasn't supposed to agree to it. So I'd been wrong three times in that respect. So, you know, I think it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow, but they should call their state senator, call their state representative, and call their governor and say, we want Atlantic time.
Emsweiler's grassroots effort just goes to show that citizens can still make a difference in their community. I'm Alex Pena.
Time is an essential ingredient in the food you eat. Many Americans may want their food fast, but preparing some foods takes considerable time. Boston reporter Cynthia Fernandez has this look at all the time required to make cheese.
At Cricket Creek Farm, out in Williamstown, Massachusetts, cheesemakers work with raw milk in a room that looks almost medically sterile. Visitors have to wear hairnets and booties over their shoes. The smell of lively farm animals is pungent. Operations manager Beth LaWand goes to the barn behind her office where the real cheesemakers are lounging.
So they all have names. You'll see their names on their ear tags. So these two are pregnant. They will probably be having calves in the next month or two.
When cows produce milk has to be critically timed. Farmers can't count on cows to yield much milk in the dead of winter, when the majority of the cow's diet is fermented hay and not the greenery of the surrounding fields. The minute variations in a cow's diet can influence what flavors a cheese ultimately presents. Adam Schutz, from the Boston Cheese Cellar, compares the quality of cheese made from raw milk to a wine.
Generally, wines vary year to year. With a cheesemaker who owns his own herd, often this will vary week to week. And so, because his herd, he or she will allow to graze in this field. And this field may have whatever type of vegetation. And then they rotate around to the next field where there may be something different. The cheesemaker has to be able to read the milk between these sort of week-to-week variations and try and balance that.
Back at the creamery, cheesemaker Chris Mulligan is stirring a vat of milk. The creamery is a warm, humid room. This allows the growth of tiny organisms, the first step to converting the milk into a cheese.
This is the beginnings of our Camembert-style cheese. This is the milk holding at a warm temperature and allowing microbes to grow and start the cheese-making process off.
Mulligan goes into one of the creamery's caves, the cool rooms where cheeses are put to age after they are salted, coagulated, cut, and put into molds. This aging process turns the curds into something recognizable as cheese. Here, the cheeses are transformed. LaWand describes the effect aging in the caves has on cheeses.
And if you go back in time to when the cheeses are just about a day old like that, pretty much all of the different cheeses that we make, they have this like same white kind of rubbery appearance and they taste, and they taste like fresh milk with just like various amounts of salt, basically.
When cheeses are given time to age, the little organisms in the milk are transformed. Again, Adam Schutz.
Aging is really, what it is a biology experiment, a microbiology experiment, that you have a block of stuff which the microbes can work on. And so you'll get more flavor if you give them a longer time to do that, because there's just, they have more time.
Back at the creamery, the cave is lined with rinds all undergoing the same change.
If we take a quick journey in time, this is the same cheese quite a ways down the road, and clearly it's changed in look.
How long does it take for it to look like it's wearing a sweater like this guy?
That's the natural flora from the air, from the environment of the cave here around it, and that starts pretty quickly. I would say after, you know, a week or so, it starts to look like a little bit of a white, just powdery coating. Then other molds will kind of take the stage. Let me see, those are made just at the beginning of the year, so 2 months, something like that. 2 months they get the sweater.
In the cave, the rind has a chance to evolve.
The surface of a cheese, the rind, is actually an example of something called a microbiome. So it's a living tapestry of microorganisms.
Cricket Creek Farm boasts two caves. The second cave houses a different variety of cheeses. And quickly, it becomes obvious why they saved this one for last.
Oh, wow, more cheese.
So much more.
Oh, wow, there's more, like, funk in this room, right?
Yeah.
Exactly,
this is
the
funky room.
Right. Most of the cheeses in this room are a branch of cheese called washed rind, which is some of the more powerful smells and flavors in the cheese world.
That living tapestry, as Schutz had called it, had ripened the cave with an inescapable smell. Although good wine doesn't get smellier with age, it does pair well with a cheese that has waited a bit longer for its debut. I'm Cynthia Fernandez.
As time moves on, tastes change. Tastes in clothing, culture, and of course, food. But a taste that does not change is the taste for sweets. They're hard to resist and also hard to avoid. Candy, cake, pie, most celebrations aren't complete without a glorious dessert. And so student reporter Coriana Moffitt looks at how entwined sweets and American culture have become.
So what are you making today?
So today we're making strawberry cupcakes with lemon Swiss buttercream frosting.
Sarah Cohen from The Sweetery started baking while growing up in Newton, Massachusetts. It quickly turned from a hobby into a passion. She has 4 handwritten recipe books that contain all of her tried and true or tried and adjusted recipes. She shares them online through her blog.
So what's the best dessert that you've ever tasted?
Oh my God. It's like asking someone with like 20 children which child is their favorite.
Turns out, Cohen does have a favorite sweet. It's lemon curd. It's what she's making to flavor the buttercream frosting.
I'll give you a taste. It's tart. It's so tart and so sweet and smooth. I mean, my mouth is watering right now as I'm describing it to you. It's, it's just so decadent. And it's a really strong flavor.
Wow.
Yeah, right?
That's really
good.
It's
a bang of flavor. You really gotta like lemon, but it's really sweet and really tart. And I could probably eat 2 cups of that in one sitting. Yeah. I also have a very high tolerance for eating sugar, but
I feel like my dad made something with this that, I don't know why it's all coming back to me.
Yep.
Memory and taste, right?
Oh, yes. Taste and memory are completely intertwined.
This is Megan Elias. She's the director of the gastronomy program at Boston University.
Right. I mean, you're tasting things all the time, but when you're tasting something new or you're asked to taste something, you're asked to have an experience with a flavor, it really does change your experience of time for a minute.
The moment you experience a new taste, your brain tries to categorize it.
It's like you're going back through the catalog of flavors in your mind to say, what is this like? Where does it fit in? Have I ever had it before? If it's something new and lovely, like, how can I have this again?
Not only can taste overwhelm your senses, it can also take you back in time. If you ask someone about a favorite food, the person almost always goes back to remembering the first bite.
So, you know, sweets and treats are something that are part of childhood. And so they have a really positive association, the time when someone is taking care of you, right, if you're lucky.
The most notable celebratory dessert, birthday cake, didn't become a part of American culture until the late 1800s.
Then after the Civil War, with a kind of a rise of a middle class, there's enough money and time to allow children to just play.
Part of why we love desserts may be rooted in nostalgia for childhood. But as sweetery baker Sarah Cohen explains, there are other uncontrollable actions at play.
The other part is that sugar is a drug. It's very specifically a drug. There have been studies done that show that what happens in the circuitry in your brain when you eat sugar is very similar to when you actually take narcotics. So it's not a joke. Sugar is a drug. It is not good for us. Everything in moderation. Oh, there's our timer.
Our craving for sugar goes deeper than you might think. Professor Karen Matheny is a food archaeologist and lecturer at Boston University. She says we are physiologically and evolutionarily hardwired to seek out high-calorie foods like sugar.
There's a reward system that is activated, not just consuming sugar, but even thinking about sugar that sends messages to our brain.
Sugar may be a drug, but according to baker Sarah Cohen, it's not going anywhere.
Do you think that's going to lead to a trend of replacing birthday cakes and birthday cupcakes with something else?
No, that's like asking if football's ever going to go away.
Now the cupcakes are out of the oven. The best of the batch will be decorated and picked up in an hour for an anniversary celebration. Each cupcake is packed with sugar. And perhaps when that sweetness hits the palate, it will bring back and create dozens of lasting memories. I'm Coriana Moffitt.
Time, time, time. It's on my side. It's an
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. On this commencement Sunday, we're hearing the work of narrative radio journalism students from the Boston University College of Communication. Their theme this semester was time. Time, or more precisely, timing, is essential for anyone who tries to make a living by telling jokes. There have always been successful women, like Carol Burnett or Tina Fey, in comedy, but only 13% of the comics on Wikipedia's list of most famous comedians are women. Student reporter Madeline Grubert has this look at the challenges women in comedy face.
Put your hands together for Ms. Nora Panahi!
Nora Panahi is a stand-up comedian and singer-songwriter. She blends her two passions to perform a unique comedic routine through music.
This is a song about my white liberal friends on Facebook who are too lazy to go out and do stuff. Think of how sweaty I get helping you plant trees. I do love the environment, though, so I'll tweet hashtag save the bees. I know we're mad at Uber for how they handle the Muslim ban, but how bad can they be if all their drivers are from Pakistan?
Panahi began doing professional stand-up in 2015 after winning a stand-up competition at Boston University. Panahi's craft relies heavily on two things: practice and comedic timing.
Yeah, so about 30 years ago, my dad left the great city of Isfahan, Iran, for the Big Apple of Wichita, Kansas. And there he met my mom, and they went on to produce two inexplicably hairy children, of which I am one.
Panahi doesn't shy away from expressing her liberal political views and often presents polarizing opinions through her comedy.
Jokes that I've told at BU don't go over as well in, like, a dive bar in the South Shore. And jokes that I tell there don't go over well at BU. So you kind of have to tailor your set to whatever venue you're playing.
Despite her sensitivity, Panahi has noticed that male comedians have more freedom to express themselves on stage, and that women are pressured out of topics having to do with feminism or the female experience.
I did a show at Laugh Boston last October. On the ride home, my ex-boyfriend was like, I feel like you played the woman card too much. You know, you're just like talking about your vagina and like, I get it, you have a vagina. Like, what else do you have? Like, can you talk about something else? And so basically just told me that I was falling back on my gender too much. And I was like, there were so many porn jokes and jacking off jokes, so many jokes about dude stuff that are the exact same joke from person to person. And I mentioned Hillary Clinton and got yelled at for it. It's very nice to be one of two female comedians performing tonight. Yeah. I was actually informed backstage, and by backstage I mean in the little drink room, that I only have 77 seconds for every 100 seconds that every male performer gets tonight. So we gotta make it count, guys.
So this is a recurring theme that has sort of kept women sidelined. I remember when Janine Garofalo was really coming into the mainstream as a comic, you know, she would talk about her period, for example. And then everyone would make fun of the fact that all she ever talks about is her period.
Deborah Jaramillo is a professor at Boston University in the Television Studies department. She teaches a course in women in comedy and says that women historically have suffered discrimination within the comedy community.
And so there's this overwhelming tendency of men and male comics to shut down women's discussions of their own experiences while men's routines are dominated by their own experiences.
In April, Panahi performed at Boston's Women in Comedy Festival. It's an event created to provide a platform for up-and-coming female comedians. In recent years, similar events have been created across the United States to combat women's marginalization and to promote inclusivity and a space for women like Panahi to flourish. I'm Madeline Grubert.
I think it's best to end this song with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He said, "There is a special place in hell reserved for those who remain silent during times of great moral conflict, and we remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." But, like, poster board is really expensive. Thank you. That's my song.
How we keep track of time is constantly evolving. The city of Cambridge is a place where technologies of the future are created, but in the heart of Harvard Square, an old technology remains in demand: watchmaking and repair. Student reporter Amy Pollard shows us how Swiss Watchmaker has been caring for watches and clocks for decades.
Swiss Watchmaker sits on a quiet stretch of Church Street in Cambridge. Step inside and you find antique watches in glass cases. Tall, dark grandfather clocks. Shiny gold clocks that look like ship's wheels. It feels like you've traveled back in time.
See, here's a watch that, it had a loose screw that was lodged in the movement. And now it's working again.
Susan Lelyveld owns the shop, where watches are sold and repaired. The 70-year-old Boston resident has been selling watches for decades. Historically, she says, the watchmaker was an essential part of the community.
The watchmaker was really part of one's life. You know, if you had a mechanical watch and you wanted it to run correctly, you had a relationship with the watchmaker.
People knew their watchmaker. They came back. On this Saturday afternoon, Swiss Watchmaker is a flurry of activity. People walk in with watches for repair, they window shop. Two watchmakers wearing goggles repair watches behind the counter, pretty much out of sight. Hubert Zulum has been working here for 10 years.
This is what you see. Sometimes I sit here, so he's doing right now. He's taking the watch apart, and he's doing the battery and changing the battery and resealing it.
Okay.
This is another watch over here. It's actually deassembled.
Watches and plastic bags pile up on the counter with notes about what needs fixing. It seems like there's never a shortage of work. But could all that be changing?
Mom, have we been here before?
Oh, yeah. This is my favorite watch store in the Boston area. It's a really unique store. They have the best selection of anywhere.
Merrill Price has come here for 30 years. But it's her daughter Hannah's first time in the shop.
I used to have a watch. I think it was from here, actually, but I don't think I ever wore it.
It was from here. And you never wore it.
I have it, though, in my dresser.
The watch industry is having a tough time. A survey from research group Ypulse found that last year, just 29% of Americans under 35 owned a traditional watch. And just 3% were planning to buy one in the next year. After all, who wears watches? Most people just check their phones nowadays. But Lelyveld still sees opportunity for watches, especially with young people.
A lot of young people have decided to wear a watch. The very classic, simplest watch has become an icon now.
And Zulum doesn't see the shop closing its doors anytime soon.
Do you see a future for this place?
Absolutely, yes. With the same leadership, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Times may be changing, but for this Boston area watchmaker, the clock's still ticking. I'm Amy Pollard.
The passage of time brings with it changes in how business is done. For example, shopping malls. They were once the center of retail activity in this country, but now malls are dying. Wall Street investment firm Credit Suisse predicts a quarter of the malls in the country will close in the next 5 years. But one mall appears ready to defy the odds. With that story, here's student reporter Patrick Levette.
The Arcade Providence is America's oldest indoor mall. Built in 1828, it is squat and framed by skyscrapers with pale, columned entrances at both ends. In 2008, it appeared the arcade's time was up. The mall was closed and listed by the city's Preservation Society as one of the area's most endangered buildings. Now the building is alive and filled with shoppers and residents, all thanks to some creative rethinking of what a mall could be. Property manager and resident Wilson Seville remembers when the place reopened.
Well, to be honest, when we opened the project in 2013, we did not know how the exact response would be, especially with the residential units, the microlofts. Now we have a waiting list of 5,000 people that have been on there throughout the past 6 years.
The microlofts that Seville mentions are each roughly the size of a one-car garage. They're trendy residential units that have drawn new people to the arcade. But it isn't just housing that's reinvigorated the mall.
It's the retail, it's the residential, it's the commercial, it's the restaurants. It's all together that helps bring people down.
You just want me to get started here? Sure.
This is Mark Cohen, Director of Retail Studies at Columbia University School of Business. He says other malls have tried adding apartments.
In some cases, there's no economic viability to redevelopment. The property has too big a mortgage load. There's too much insecurity about the viability of the space geographically. And so these are kind of like just dying on the vine. All the best plans of mice and men go awry if the customer just doesn't get it.
At the Arcade Providence, people do get it. Just ask Christine Francis. She has worked at an antique shop at the mall since it reopened in 2013. She describes a typical scene at the coffee shop and whiskey bar a few doors down.
You have a lot of people that will, I'll come down, you'll see like tenants and business owners hanging out in there, you know, over the years. And they come and go, different people who have lived here and come and gone. But that's sort of a not an uncommon thing to be in there and see, you know, a bunch of people interacting in that way.
This environment, Professor Cohen says, is both a sign and cause of success.
The idea of community is often used as the basis of redevelopment. And the question is whether the community really is there with enough mass to do enough business to warrant the investment involved. And some of these work and some of them just don't, because they just don't have enough magic attached to them, or there's not enough weight to them for them to be successful.
Cohen argues the shopping mall is not necessarily dead. But to survive, he says malls need to innovate. In Providence, the lure of working, living, and shopping, all under the same roof, is paying off. I'm Patrick Lovett.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard stories about time told by narrative radio journalism students from the BU College of Communication. Stories were edited by Professor Ann Donahue. Our audio producers are Mike Garth and Paul Kahlo, with help from Matt Lissette. For a CD of this week's show, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to WBUR.org to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.